Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
And welcome back, everybody, to Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. I've got an awesome guest for you today. Somebody who's put their neck out for truth, for liberty, for justice. Holland van den Nieuwenhof is with us today, the maker of A Noble Lie. This filmmaker has put it together, and you're going to be blown away if you haven't seen this movie yet. A Noble Lie, about the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995. First, though, a couple of announcements with my wonderful wife and assistant, Ms. Gail Gage. Hello, Gail.
Hello, Richard, and hello, everybody.
Yeah, awesome to be back again. We had a big trip, didn't we? Want to tell everybody about it?
Yes, we did. Oh my gosh. So we took our little camp trailer and we drove all the way down to Salem, Oregon, which for us is about a 7-hour drive. And it was the Reawaken America conference. It's a conference, but it's a tour. This huge group of these wonderful patriots, doctors, General Flynn, different people travel around and go on this tour. But the one that we were at down there in Salem, General Flynn did show up, and then Eric Trump was there, and a lot of doctors and attorneys, and
they're speaking to 5,000 people. Also, I mean, we were among them. We had a table. We were there representing the 9/11 truth movement. We spoke to a lot of people, handed out a lot of brochures, and sold some DVDs, which helps keep us doing what we love to do, and that is reaching out to the public. Did you have a notable moment, Gail?
Well, for me, I was very surprised and very happy that the fact that maybe because of the audience that was there, pretty much everybody that I spoke with at our table or around during the event was very aware that 9/11 was a false flag event. Do not believe the official story. But I was a little surprised, on the other hand, that several people had never heard that there was a third building. They didn't know about Building 7, World Trade Center Building 7, that collapsed.
I love it when that happens.
I know, right? Exactly. And when they hear that, the ones at this conference were like, well, we knew 9/11 wasn't, you know, it was a false flag, but we didn't know there was a third building. So they intuitively knew or done their homework to find out that, yeah, that was a false flag. But so that for me was just very reaffirming and just wonderful to see so many people awake about 9/11.
And so here's how I do that. I have the brochure, which is, did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? And it's got all the evidence in it. You can see it on our website, richardgage911.org. And I hand it to them. They're walking by the booth. I hand it to them and say, did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? Some of them go, oh, yeah, I knew. And I say, well, will you take this and share it with somebody who doesn't? And if they don't, they stop. They go, what are you talking about, a third tower? So it's pretty incredible. Either way, we have a lot of conversations. And yeah, I was just shocked that in this conservative crowd, you go to CPAC or something, which I've never been to. It's not like that. This is a different conservative crowd than CPAC. They're awake about COVID. They're awake about 9/11. They're awake about the dangerous solution to the false problem that we're all of the disease going around. Is what I meant to say there. It's unusual. So they're more accustomed to the truth about 9/11, as is our guest today, which we're going to be introducing in a moment. But first, Gail, what guests have we had on recently, and what's coming up?
Well, the last two guests that we had was Art Olivier. He's the filmmaker of Operation Terror. That was awesome. And I really enjoyed his film too. And then before that, we had Foster Gamble with Thrive On for A Free World. And
an incredible interview.
Yeah, both of those, I thought. But yeah, Foster Gamble, wow, I was so happy that we were able to interview him. And then coming up, we have John Perkins.
Yeah, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He is all over the 9/11 truth. So we're going to talk to him about he's got several books. It's amazing. Now he's talking about consciousness and waking up, not just being to the truth about the deceptions foisted upon us by the deep state, but our own deep state inside of us, overcoming that. Go ahead, Gail.
Wow. And then after that, we have Leroy Holsey, which I am so happy. It's going to be so wonderful to have Leroy on. Richard, you can tell. Everybody should be familiar with him and his study.
He is the forensic structural engineer, one of the top in the country, who was the, a decade or something, the civil engineering chair at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. When I was at AE 9/11 Truth, which I'm not anymore, by the way, I started a new organization. I've outgrown the last one. And here I am, brand new with my helper, Gail. We are marching forward with the results of the successes that we had while we were at AE 9/11 Truth, such as Leroy Holsey, whom we raised $300,000 to have him initiate a four-year finite element analysis on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. And the results are startling, completely pulls the rug out from underneath the NIST report. But anyway, well, that's going to be awesome. What date is he on?
Let's see. That would be next Thursday. Sorry.
All right,
and I'm not sure what the exact date is.
And John Perkins?
Is next Tuesday.
Okay, Tuesday and Thursday. That's what's happening next week, guys.
Next week, yes.
Yes, and let me tell you about my guest today then. Oh, and we'll come back about questions and that people can ask. But that's all the announcements, right, Gail, or is there more?
Well, we do have an interview coming up this Sunday with a wonderful woman. Her name's Lorianne Kellett. She has a talk radio show called Lucid Libertarian, and she is interviewing both Richard and I this Sunday, this coming Sunday. So that's going to be
fun. This is Gail's first interview.
Yeah, you were. Yeah.
Yep. We're going to tell her all about the conference last week.
Yes. And she has interviewed you about 6 months ago or so. She interviewed you. And then, yes, and so now together.
We've done some amazing interviews, and we're putting them up on the website. So be sure to, and you'll get them in an email if you're signed up on our email sign-up list, which you can do very easily on our website, richardgage911.org. You don't want to miss anything. So one of the interviews that we had is a debate with Sam Tripoli's co-host, Brian. And there's two of them, and Gail's going to find both of them today, and we're going to post those today as well. Be sure to make a note of that, Gail, because we got to get that going. All right, my guest today is Holland van den Nieuwenhoff, the writer and producer of A Noble Lie, the first full-length documentary proving the official story of the Murrah Building bombing as myth. He's the relentless truth warrior that reveals the precursor psychological operation to 9/11, that being Oklahoma City bombing. Why was there overwhelming evidence of foreknowledge of the 1995 Murrah Building bombing among federal officials, yet no one stepped in to stop the deadly attack which killed 168 Americans? Why were there two separate blasts, approximately 10 seconds apart, heard by witnesses and recorded at the nearby seismic station, yet officials maintain that only one blast occurs? And why is that so very important? Why were there repeated public announcements of additional undetonated bombs found in the building, yet officials later deny all of them? Why was the 10-foot round crater under the Ryder truck so far off center from the damage pattern of the building? If the Ryder truck was parked in front of the Murrah building, why was so much of the debris blown past the truck into the street and into the facade of the building across the street? Why was the Clinton Whitewater documents and other key prosecutorial legal evidence moved into the Murrah building before the attack, only to be lost, of course? Why was the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act ready to go right after the bombing? My guest is Holland Vanden Nieuwenhoff, a native Oklahoman who formerly served in the U.S. Marine Corps as a rifle squad leader. His broadcasting career started in 2007 as co-host on Radio Free Oklahoma, and later as co-host on the Free Mind Report. Holland is also the writer and producer of this movie we're talking about today, A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. The first full-length documentary examining the Oklahoma City bombing in the light of new and suppressed evidence that proves the official story is a deep state operation. He joins us to shed light on the questions long ignored and censored in the mainstream media about the Oklahoma City bombing. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Holland Vanden Nieuwenhoff. Hi, Holland.
Hello, Richard. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on and to talk to you once again.
Oh, it's incredible. We go way back, and I've always been so impressed with the work that we're going to be looking at today. Before we get into it, though, let's have Gail tell us how our viewers can ask questions of you when we're done talking to you.
Yes. So, excuse me. So on your social media platform that you're on, probably Facebook or YouTube and LinkedIn, under the video is the comments section where you can put in your comments. So put your questions in there, and then I copy and paste them over and ask our guests at the end of the podcast. So it's real simple. Unfortunately, it's sad that I have to say this, but please keep your questions and comments very mature and adult. And
you can do it, guys.
Kind, because I will delete your comments or question and block you if you don't. So
without warning, too.
Without warning, yes, exactly. So we're not going to. The toleration level has gone way down.
All right. So we'll come back and look for you, Gail. Is there anything else?
No.
All right. Thanks. We'll let you go do your job. Catch up with you soon. Holland, when did you first become aware of the truth about 9/11?
Well, actually, not just a few months after 9/11. I was basically I was getting ready to reenlist in the Marine Corps. Okay. I served in the Marine Corps from 1995 through 1999. And obviously 9/11 was in 2001, and I was getting ready to reenlist. And I don't know if I've ever told this story publicly before, but I was talking to a very good friend of mine who happened to be the producer at the time for Alex Jones, the Alex Jones Show out of Austin. He was kind of small potatoes back then, but obviously now he's a big deal. He's been in national media plenty of times. And I was discussing this. He was a friend of mine, and we were discussing. I was discussing that, you know, I'm going back in because, well, we're going to war. And he sat me down by a campfire and told me some things that were very disconcerting about what had happened at 9/11. That perhaps the government knew about it. That elements perhaps were involved in facilitating it. And I felt that, well, I don't know if I can reenlist under, now that I know that it might be under false pretenses. Mm-hmm. And I was also, you know, getting ready to start a family at the time, so it didn't feel like quite proper to run off and go to war. But that was my first sit down talk. And someone told me some of the things that were going on with 9/11, because I was aware, fully aware, almost fully aware of what had happened, transpired in Oklahoma City, which we'll get into. but I was still, I couldn't believe, and this was psychological on my part, I couldn't believe that the government or elements of the government would take it that far. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I really, someone had to sit me down and explain the facts of life to me. So, yeah.
Oh my God. So how did that lead you to Oklahoma City, or did it?
Well, I was, when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, I was in the Marine Corps. So I had a lot of other things going on at the time. So I actually did not pay a whole lot of attention to
that
the
was
story.
Your hometown.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember I was actually in the chow hall at the School of Infantry, and I look up at the TV while I'm eating, and Oklahoma City's on the news, and there's a bombed out building. So obviously I made my calls to make sure everyone was all right. And I was already hearing through the grapevine rumors that the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, that their office was empty on the day of the bombing. They were in the Murrah building. So, but I frankly, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention. I was paying attention to my Marine Corps career. When I got out in 1999 and I moved back to Oklahoma eventually, I started conducting research and working basically with the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee that was chaired by State Representative Charles Key. And they were conducting a grand jury investigation into the bombing. And I came onto the scene after that and was basically helping them out with their continuing research and investigation. And it became, we were always discussing the best way to get this information out to the public because there was just so much information. And we felt, although very few of us had a background, and this was a team effort. When he introduced me as the creator and writer and producer of the film, I am co-writer, co-producer. This was a team effort by largely native Oklahomans. Mm. And we decided that documentary film was at the time the best way to get this information out there. So we started working on a documentary, and it turned into a 2-year-long effort. And we released it in 2012. And it won a number of awards at film festivals, independent film festivals, and it's well received. And if someone wants to watch it, I advise you don't have to pay anyone. Just look it up for free on BitChute or Rumble. And all you do is search for A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. And several versions should come up, A Noble Lie. And it's a 2-hour-long documentary. And really, I have been told several times by several different people that this film really served as the wake-up tool for them. When people are able to see how craven certain elements of the government can be to fulfill an agenda, they become aware of other things they're capable of. So,
yeah. Well, let's give them a taste of it right now. Here's the trailer. We'll watch it together.
On April 19th, 1995, at 9:02 a.m., explosions tore through the Alfred P. Murrah Building in downtown Oklahoma City, ripping through the consciousness of America. 169 people were left dead and hundreds more injured. The Oklahoma City bombing was the largest act of terrorism on American soil until 9/11. America had a new demon. We're now being told that this demon is emerging from its slumber. Since that day of horror, groundbreaking new information has come to light, so provocative, so explosive, that it threatens to shatter everything we thought we knew about the true nature of terrorism.
We'll pursue every lead and use every possible resource to bring the people responsible to justice.
I was sitting at my desk there on the 8th floor. I felt the building start shaking, lights went out. Debris started falling on my desk. Something hit me in the back of the head and knocked me out before the truck bomb went off. What that tells you is that there were other explosive devices in the building that actually brought the building down.
It's an earthquake. Everybody get down on underneath on the floor. And I had sat there and I thought, you know, it doesn't feel like an earthquake. 7 or 8 seconds later, I felt this explosion.
Only an imbecile would look at that damage pattern and not understand that it couldn't have been made by a truck bomb, because a truck bomb is going to release its energy simultaneously in every direction.
The record clearly shows that Dr. Jolly and West consulted Timothy McVeigh's defense team. Dr. West had previously been psychiatrist and consulted for Patty Hearst, Saran Saran, and Jack Ruby.
We know that Jolly and West was considered to be the number two mind control expert in North America under only Dr. Ewing Cameron. We know that he was McVeigh's doctor from the time around the trial to the time he was incarcerated in Terre Haute, Indiana, and then executed.
Even though the spin was, it was the right wing, it was the militias, McVeigh was involved in all this stuff, he did it because of Waco, and all this stuff that the media was pumping out, none of it panned out. The militia in those days would have guarded the Murrah building. Now, they wouldn't have guarded the UN.
I wrote a letter to the district attorney, Macy, told him what I had seen and that I wanted to testify in the grand jury. I got a letter back from him telling me that the grand jury did not want to hear anything I had to say about the bombing.
It is every patriotic American's duty, every man, woman, and child's responsibility to research the facts contained in this film, to verify for yourself that this information is true, that the rabbit hole goes even deeper, and then take action to bring the criminals that perpetrated this attack to justice. If we don't, they're going to win and bring down our republic in the process.
Coming soon.
April 19th, 1995 at 9:02 a.m. Explosion.
It's actually here. How cool is that? Holland, what does that bring back memories? It's been how long since you made this film?
10 years.
Yeah.
10 years. Yes, it does. That was quite a journey. It kind of defined my life. It did. And, you know, a lot of things happened in the making of that film that were really just fortunate, luck-wise. Just access to witnesses and material, people providing us material, that really compels me to think that the film had to be made, needed to be made, and someone wanted it to be made to tell the truth about what had happened. And we're not trying to answer all the questions. We're asking the questions that the government refuses to answer and, in fact, sometimes lies about. So,
yeah. Where did you start with the film? Tell us a story.
Well, the film, basically, we tried to follow the arc of revelation that actually happened in real life. And the first information we go with in the film was some of the first tidbits that came out from the bombing that were coming out to the public and people involved that something was funny. Not funny, but something was untoward. And that would be that the fact that the target of the bombing. Now, I'll go through a little history because the Oklahoma City bombing was over 20 years ago, and it has been largely overshadowed by many large recent events. But in 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing happened in Oklahoma City. The federal building was targeted ostensibly by a truck bomb. And the reason for this was supposedly as retribution, revenge against the federal government for their actions at the Waco siege that had concluded 2 years previously on that date, on the anniversary, April 19th, which is coming up. But on April 19th, 1993, the Waco Branch Davidian siege had ended in a massive fire that killed everyone involved inside the buildings, almost everyone. And the FBI was largely blamed for this conflagration by many elements, including the supposed lone perpetrator, Timothy McVeigh, who supposedly targeted the federal building and the ATF office there, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. But the fact is that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms office was empty that day.
Oh.
On a work day. And almost sounds too good to be true. And the ATF offered several easily disproven lies about why they weren't there. One story was that all of their agents were at a golf tournament. This turned out to be false and was dropped. One story was that they were on an all-night stakeout the previous night. This may or may not be true, but not all of the office was there. on this operation. Many of them were admitted they were notified by their pager to not come into work on April 19th.
They admitted this?
Yes. On stand, on camera, and but no explanation. These agents themselves, really, they did not know why.
Sure.
But maybe some of them did. I don't know. But the ATF was gone. Okay. And that was some, and those, and that information was offered up by rescue workers, people in the building. And these are all government employees.
And their kids were in the daycare center? They were supposed to be?
There was a child care facility, a daycare in the Murrah building. Almost every child in that daycare was killed, if not all of them. I believe 19 children. And that was, but the problem was, and this later came out, that the FBI and ATF had pulled their children out of the daycare. That became proven. And but the other people in the building were not told of this. And that information was revealed by an IRS employee who worked in the building. Like I said, all of our witnesses we present in the film, almost all of them were former government employees. This was a federal building, or government employees at the time of the bombing. There was a wealth of evidence that we merely had to cherry pick, pick the most succulent tidbits that would sink into the eyes and ears of the public, of the viewing audience. And this is what we presented in the film.
Wow. Well, so I've got a lot of notes because I watched this film and I was just deeply moved. There's evidence of foreknowledge that you brought out in the film, just like on 9/11. People know in advance that Building 7's coming down. Giuliani knew that the towers were coming down and he was told they were going to come down. What kind of foreknowledge did you have the Murrah building?
Well, we know that there were, and we present this in the film, there were several warnings passed by federal law enforcement that government or federal buildings were being targeted in this time frame for an attack, specifically on April 19th. Now, these may be dismissed as, just whatever is going through the mind of the federal law enforcement community at the time, but these forewarnings turned out to be true. The attack happened. One piece of evidence we present in the film is the fact that a phone call was made to the from Oklahoma City to the Department of Justice in D.C., telling them that the Murrah building had just exploded. But this phone call was conducted an hour before the bombing. We don't know what this phone call was about. We don't know. But we present a lot of evidence in the film that some government agencies were aware, and the fact that the ATF office was empty, that they lied about their reasons, and that the FBI knew it was happening, and they were present on scene as the explosion occurred. And why this is significant is the FBI office was not in the Murrah building. It was about 5 miles away. And the first Oklahoma City police officer to respond to the bombing, Terry Yakey, he was there 4 minutes after the building exploded, and he was an experienced police officer. And he reported for the record that there were several FBI agents that he knew or knew of and recognized, basically watching what was happening there. Why were they there? He also noted that the parking lot across the street from the Murrah building was packed with out-of-state federal law enforcement vehicles.
Oh.
So there appeared to be something happening. The head of FBI counterterrorism, who was based in Dallas, for some reason made a trip to Oklahoma the night before the bombing, then lied about it. He would have gotten away with that lie, but we acquired his hotel records, and he was in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, that is, the night previous to the bombing. Yet he lied about it. No explanation. Mm-hmm. So it does appear that certain elements. And I want to be very clear that I'm not demonizing. I am a supporter of law enforcement, even federal law enforcement. And I have a lot of friends who've gone into law enforcement. I was in the Marine Corps and have worked with the FBI. And some of these friends assure me that the FBI agents that they work with are diligent patriots who would never do anything. And you know what? I believe them. But it just takes an element, a controlling element, to be able to influence events in a controlled environment, need to know, compartmentalized investigation. All it takes is basically a few corrupt bosses. And you'll also I'm sure those same FBI agents will tell you how corrupt their bosses are to manipulate events. So I'm not trying to demonize law enforcement or any of that. I'm mortally offended that law enforcement, some elements of law enforcement, have taken part in conspiratorial crimes against the public.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So we've got agents packing the parking lot across the street doing nothing for what, 4 or 5 minutes or more?
They were not responding. They were watching. Officer Terrence Hickey said they were watching.
I mean, now, we can get creepy.
Yes, and we can get more into Terrence Hickey later, but you know, he died a year after the bombing under very mysterious circumstances. He was a whistleblower for local law enforcement, and he died under extremely dubious circumstances.
Well, okay, and we'll come back to Terrence Yakey because that's an incredible story. Let's talk about the bombs. Apparently, there are witnesses of more than one bomb. Of course, the official story is that a truck bomb full of ammonium nitrate was parked in front. Tell us a story about how it got in front of the building, and because you have information on that, and was it or was it not the only bomb?
Okay, well, the official story dictates that the lone cause of destruction to the Murrah building that morning was a truck filled with a fertilizer bomb, basically ammonium nitrate laced with diesel oil and also the detonator being explosives that were stolen from a mining quarry in Kansas. The government insists this is the lone cause of destruction. What we showcase and demonstrate without error in the film is that this is impossible. When getting into more explosions, yes, the U.S. Geological Survey in Oklahoma City did record two energetic events up to 10 seconds apart, and they stuck to their guns. They did not get into speculation about who, what, where, why. They just said, and they did not deviate, that there were two unrelated energetic events, that the second event was not air blast or echo bouncing off the ground. They stuck their professional reputations on this. And then these are federal employees. That's the U.S. Geological Survey. And there were other bombs in the building. The ATF, the Bureau of Fire, we have taken statements from witnesses who cannot come forward, but we do talk about them because to protect their safety. At the time, they were still working for the government. One of them was a sheriff's deputy, and I took an affidavit from him where he stated that the ATF informed each other while he was sitting there listening. He was on the rescue effort, that they had swabbed the interior columns of the building and they had tested positive for C4. This is not definitive proof, but this is what the ATF was discussing the day of. In the film, we have footage from the building, and this footage, we did not source it in the film because basically it was leaked to us by a film crew that was working for the government. After the bombing, when the media was pushed back from the building, the only film crews allowed up close were those who were employed by the government. And one of the branches of the government, the military, had a film crew there. And I knew one of them. He gave us the footage. And in that footage, which we have in the film, we did not discuss it at length in the film. We just showed it because we don't want to get anyone in trouble. It shows them taking C4 plastic explosive out of the building, putting it on stretchers and pulling it out. And this little factoid is going to be actually receiving more news attention, believe it or not, in the near future. Fox News talk show host Tucker Carlson, his producer, has been working with one of our witnesses, Jesse Trentidou, who's interviewed in the film. And they are producing a witness. This is not someone that I knew about before. This is something else that those people have come up with. A witness, a government employee, who says that the ATF was keeping an illegal armory in the building packed with confiscated explosives, which was illegal. under every law in the books. That was a public federal building with a daycare and all that. And there were no safeguards taken. It was merely a safe. And we knew this from day one. Okay. Rescue effort workers were tasked to evacuate the unexploded ordnance that had fallen out of that safe from the building. One rescue worker who was ordered to pull explosives out of that armory was particularly upset because he could hear children crying in the rubble. And he was not being tasked to help them. He was being tasked to evacuate these explosives. And he went on the record, affidavit. There is a book out there that a lot of the material in the film is based upon. And that was a book put out. It's called Final Report of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. That was a report put out by the grand jury investigation talking about this and has the affidavits firsthand from the first responders. Anyways, this story apparently is going to be receiving attention again very soon because the producer for Tucker was talking about it on Twitter.
Well, the presumably the cover story at least was that he was tasked with recovering these explosives because they posed a danger to the rescue effort.
Yes.
Is that what they're saying?
But they were told not to talk about it.
Okay. They did anyway. Be there in the first place.
Yeah. It was illegal. A whole lot of people would get in trouble for that. They were told not to discuss it.
Could that account for the positive tests?
No. The residue test is from the explosive chemical reaction or the presence of C4 on those columns.
On the exploded columns.
And I also, we took a statement from a firefighter. He was on the rescue squad for the Oklahoma City Police Department. We did not put this in the film because he was still working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. And what he told us was, well, I still have kids. And I said, I understand. He said that we could use his information, but not to name him. He was on the Oklahoma City Rescue Squad, basically their SWAT team, the team that trains for events of this nature, for special event rescue missions. They were the first ones into the parking garage of the bombing of the building. And the first thing they noticed, what he told us, was that there was unexploded C4 plastic explosive still strapped to the columns with the detonating cord hanging off. They weren't worried about it because they had trained on this stuff particularly. They said it was military in origin. I'm not saying the military did it, but they said it was military C4. And they knew it was safe. As long as there's not a detonation process, you can go and jump on it if you want. It's not going to go off. It's very stable. And so they just continued on their rescue mission. They noted it, they called it in, and they started pulling people out. So the Oklahoma City Fire Department Rescue Squad, and I'm not going to give it a specific name, they were pulled off the rescue effort that evening. The rescue effort took several days before they determined that there was no one left alive in there. Several days and several of recovering bodies. But the one team trained and tasked for this task was pulled off the event and taken to the federal prison mental health facility in Springfield, Illinois, for 30 days, ostensibly for treatment of PTSD. And they were made to sign a lot of paperwork, and they discussed what they had seen.
Wow.
The C4 in the parking garage, and these federal head shrinkers were trying to tell them that it was due to trauma and they didn't see what they saw. And basically, they just signed every piece of paper they could so they could go home. I mean, they were in prison. Okay. They're in a prison psychiatric facility. They wanted
probably
to go home.
With medication, too.
Yes. And so they got sent home and now they all have mental illness things on their record. So, Illinois. If they ever decide to come forward, you know, the government could just say they're crazy. So, and they're not. They're not going to come forward. But they did want us to know. And we did take the interview.
You talked to a few of them, huh?
I talked to one, and he said that he was the only one going to be talking to anyone. But they wanted him to get the information out.
Oh, I'm glad. Oh, good. Wow. That's powerful, right?
So there were unexploded devices. And these were reported in the news the day of. This is not... We went after these leads because the news, the local news, was reporting that day, evacuations, haltings of the rescue efforts to secure and remove more explosives that the government has never explained and later said were false reports. However, we do know that at least one of these evacuation efforts that they called was not so much for any unexploded ordnance, but was to remove paperwork from the building. We have Oklahoma City Police Officer Don Browning. He was with the canine team at the Murrah building. And they were ordered by the FBI to halt the rescue and to pull off site because, quote, there were documents so important to national security that the rescue would be halted. And if people lost their lives, so be it. Because the local law enforcement was about, you know, to get in fisticuffs with the feds. The feds threatened to arrest them if they went back on site to pull people out. The feds themselves conducted basically a military-style police call, walking fingertip to fingertip across the rubble and across the surrounding streets, picking up every piece of paper that was fluttering in the wind while people were bleeding out inside. And rescue workers went on the record with this, and they were upset because they said, and as we show in the film, one nurse saying that people did die while they were conducting these halts in the rescue efforts. And one rescue worker, Tiffany Bible, her affidavit is in the book, Final Report of the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee, that FBI agents were literally stepping over still alive victims who needed help to pick up paper and then walking on and leaving them. So yes, they wanted, and we know the nature of some of the paperwork that they were pulling out. We don't know what everything was, but as shown in the film, Tulsa Police Officer Craig Roberts, who was employed on the federal investigation, he worked for the FBI. How the FBI works is they oftentimes, most of their personnel in local investigation will be local PD who are seconded to federal law enforcement to carry out investigative duties. And Craig Roberts was that guy for the Oklahoma FBI. And he was involved and asked for to be on the investigation by the FBI. They retained him, and a IRS special investigator called him while he was on the job and told him that all of the Whitewater investigative documents into the Clinton, President Clinton's doings in Arkansas when he was governor, which were under criminal federal investigation, that all of those records were being kept in the Murrah building. And Kenneth Starr, the prosecutor of the Whitewater case, admitted so and said the case was affected by the destruction of these records. And we also know that the records for the class action lawsuit by U.S. military veterans against the Department of Defense for Gulf War syndrome, for the FDA requirements on vaccines being waived and them being subjected to basically being guinea pigs for these wide array of vaccines that caused so much damage to hundreds of thousands of veterans, that lawsuit and those records, though those were being kept, the military records were being kept in the Murrah building. So I do not know if that was the absolute only or even any reason, but we do know that pertaining to the documents, that's something they were interested in, both cases. There was probably more.
Wow. So that's the paperwork that was moved into the Murrah building before the bombing. Mm-hmm. At some point, we don't know how soon before, but I had heard that it was pretty soon before within a year.
Whenever the federal Whitewater investigation started, by law, federal law, they had to move all of those documents out of the federal district in which it occurred because they were investigating a government official, Bill Clinton. The closest federal building to Arkansas was the Murrah building in Oklahoma City, and all the records were moved there.
Okay.
Yeah, at the beginning of the Whitewater investigation.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
Now back to this blast. We got this lady in the trailer we just saw. She thought she felt an earthquake, and then she said 7 or 8 seconds later there was the blast. Can you talk about these two different events and what they might mean with respect to each other?
We have several witnesses, two of whom we interview in the film and express that evidence, that the building started to shake and come apart before, approximately 7-8 seconds before the explosion of the truck bomb outside the building. They were two separate events. There was the interior destruction of the building, which was recorded by a number of, actually three witnesses in the film talk about this. And then the truck bomb outside exploded, basically just blowing in the facade of the building. But as we demonstrated in the film, interviewing experts on that particular subject, it was physically, mathematically, chemically impossible for whatever concoction the government says there was, because that's an ever-changing story. Whatever was in the truck could not have caused the destruction to the interior columns of the Mura building. That is a scientific fact. And we have those witnesses in the film, and I can discuss those.
Yeah, but General
Benton K. Parton, the inventor of the smart bomb, who conducted a government investigation of the bombing for the Air Force. The Air Force concluded that, like, the government, the federal government is not a monolith. Okay. They don't know what the other hand is doing. Okay. The Air Force conducted a simulation of the Oklahoma City bombing at Eglin Air Force Base using test structures. Oh. And their conclusion on this report, now this report was available online until the film happened. Then it got yanked down. I printed it out. I have a hard copy. I have maybe the only, I need to put it online. But we showed the document in the film. The Air Force concluded that the destruction of the Mura building could only have come about as a result of interior explosions. Hmm. And they blew up several structures with what the government said they used. In fact, they even had to use a more powerful bomb, because what the Air Force discovered was that whatever the FBI was saying was in the truck was doing almost nothing to their test structure. Okay. It was, wow. They had to actually come put a real bomb in there, a much more powerful one. And it did not do the damage to their test structure, which was weaker than the Mura building, than what actually happened at Oklahoma City, in their own conclusion, saying there had to be interior explosions.
And General Parton, who's an expert on this, same thing. So, So the earthquake that she felt was a result of maybe one or more C4s against columns. And then 7 or 8 seconds later, this bomb went off in the Ryder truck. But the building didn't come down in that 7 seconds. So there must have been some synchronization going on, that maybe one of these explosions went off at the wrong time 7 seconds earlier. And then simultaneously, 7 seconds later, the Ryder truck goes off with the rest of these bombs, and that brings down the buildings properly synchronized.
It was improperly synchronized because, well, there was a foul up. Remember, this is government work. The only reason they're able to get away with any of this stuff is that the media is complicit in the cover up. Okay. Otherwise it wouldn't work, but it was a government job and they messed up. The movements of the Ryder truck that morning had largely been a mystery to many of us, because it was pulling into several different parking spots. It tried to go into the parking garage. It even tried to park in an alley. Then it drove away that morning to a tire shop in downtown Oklahoma City, which was actually the highest point in that part of town. So where speculation was that they needed to establish communication. What it turns out is that the Ryder truck that Timothy McVeigh rented for the job was too large to get into the parking garage. The truck bomb was supposed to be in the parking garage. That's where the majority of the columns were laced with C4. It was supposed to be a simultaneous explosion. One or the other would set the other off. They would go off at the same time. And had that occurred, it would have been nigh impossible to prove that the government is lying about it, because the path of destruction would have been symmetrical and in line with the available evidence. Mm-hmm. As it is, the truck bomb and the crater outside the building is offset. It doesn't line up with the major damage. Can you describe
that in detail?
Oh, yes. And we show in graphic detail and with schematics how the crater does not line up with the major damage to the building at all. It's totally off. It's not, they don't even match up. They don't line up. And that's not how explosive waves work. They work in a uniform direction. And this is all, I mean, people like yourself and others in your field, these are things that can be calculated. None of this is a mystery. Explosive force upon architecture and how buildings are made. All of these materials are known and how they react and how these bombs react. And the blast wave from the truck bomb is mathematically impossible to dissolve concrete inside the building and leave, you know, structures between the column and the truck bomb totally intact. Sheetrock still strapped to the columns. They're fine. But a column behind it is absolutely dissolved. Not broken. I'm saying it wasn't a failure. They didn't just break. They were dissolved. This was contact explosives that dissolved the concrete and left the rebar sticking out. They left smooth edges. These weren't cracked and broken concrete. Smooth edges to the ends of these support columns that General Benton K. Pardon indicated is direct evidence of what he termed brisance damage. And that is contact damage from explosives. He said the columns were strapped. There's no way it was a blast wave. Impossible.
And that's what the witnesses saw. Yes. In fact, they saw it after the bombing in the parking garage, is what you said. And they were still strapped. They called it in and they went on to their rescue. Apparently those ones didn't go off. So I'm wondering how many didn't go off. I guess the whole building would have fallen if they all went off.
Likely. But yes, there were several explosions. And here's the thing. We also have a witness in the film who saw the explosives being placed there. Okay. Jane Graham, she was in the trailer. She's a very credible witness. As crazy as it sounds, her story.
The trailer.
You have to see it. Yeah.
The movie trailer.
Yeah. She was shown briefly in there. Jane Graham was vice president of the Federal Employees Union for Oklahoma. She had testified before Congress several times. Very credible witness. She saw a crew in the parking garage when she came in. And she describes it in the film, and she described this to police, and she picked one of the guys out of a lineup, okay? And he turned out to be a federal informant, the guy she picked out of the lineup, Andrea Strassmeyer. She saw a crew in their parking garage. Now, she was a civilian. She had no familiarity with explosives or anything like that whatsoever. She thought they were maybe maintenance telephone guys because they had a bunch of white wire and gray putty. Well, that is detonating cord or detonation cord or C4 plastic explosive. She didn't know what it was, but immediately after the bombing, obviously, she reported it to the police. They showed her a lineup, and then she picked out a guy out of the lineup. His name, he was a German national. He was named Andreas Strassmeyer. The reason he was in the lineup was he was a suspect. And then he was dropped from being a suspect because it turned out that, well, he's a federal law enforcement informant. So that was dropped. So
I'm going to get him out of there.
The evidence that we present is quite literally explosive, and it cannot be denied. And it was only the power of the media that allowed this to happen, because any objective investigation like ours would have uncovered this and broadcast it to the world. But the media was complicit and allowed it to happen. And we know how some of that occurred. I am personal friends with a producer for ABC 2020 at the time, Colonel Roger Charles. And he produced an ABC 2020 segment on the ATF being absent from the building. This was on the news, clips of it in the film. And he presented a second, much more digging deeper segment for ABC's 2020. He produced it. And he was sitting at home watching for it to come on, and they canceled it. They showed some sitcom instead. So he called his boss. He's like, "What is going on?" And he said, "Well, we had to cut it." And he said, "Why?" They said, "Well, we kept on getting calls from the Justice Department. They're pestering us that if we keep on talking about the ATF, that they might get dissolved. And that would lead to machine guns on the street and, you know, Wild West shootouts everywhere because the ATF is not there to enforce gun laws." So,
oh my God,
we're cutting it. So,
so that's the name of your movie, A Noble Lie.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes you have to lie as a government to keep, make sure the people are safe, I guess. Jeez.
They believe it and they certainly follow through on it. And a noble lie that it was not my idea. It was from our director, James Lane, and it's from Plato's Republic, his book. He talks about the noble lie, and Plato was an advocate of the noble lie. He believes that the ruling class must engage in myths for stability. And he referred to these as noble lies. So that apparently is what Oklahoma City was an embodiment of.
Yeah, 9/11 as well. So going back to this Andre Strauss-Meyer, there's a John Doe. People saw John Doe number two. People saw somebody with McVeigh in several situations, right? And then tell us
every situation. McVeigh was never alone. That's the thing. Like Oklahoma City is like one of the most easily disproven official stories there ever was. Every situation in which McVeigh was reported to be seen by witnesses, he was not by himself. And these people are largely unmolested by law enforcement. They're allowed to continue their lives. That's, in fact, the federal government, even during the trial, they only produced one witness to place McVeigh at the building. And under cross-examination, this witness admitted, yes, he was with other people. Okay. McVeigh was not alone. We interviewed several people. I interviewed McVeigh's roommate in the Army. The guy who served with him in the Gulf War on the same Bradley fighting vehicle as he did. Like you get pretty close to a guy in the military when you're sharing the same vehicle and sharing the same room. I know, closer than brothers. You know the other person. And what McVeigh's roommate told me in person while I'm sitting there interviewing him, that McVeigh, quote, was a total tool. He was a order follower. Quote, you could tell him to spit shine concrete and he would do it. And this description of McVeigh is reinforced by other people who worked with him after the military. When McVeigh worked for the security company, his superiors there commented that he was the kind of guy who would just sit there and tell him to guard a door. Nothing happening for 8 hours straight. And he would do it with no complaints. When he worked at Ace Hardware, his coworker said he was the kind of guy who you would tell him to stack up like 100 folding chairs, put them against the wall, then restack them and put them back out, and he wouldn't even ask a question. His Army roommate also told me that McVeigh, you know, quote, could be punked out by a third grader. He was a complete follower. What McVeigh's roommate told me was that he had no doubt that McVeigh was involved, but there is no way he was in charge. He was never in charge of anything, but he would do whatever he was told. And I believe him. And everyone who reported McVeigh, hundreds, if not thousands of eyewitness statements to the FBI, me and my fellow researchers have probably read more FBI witness statements than the average FBI agent. We've gone through all of these. He was never alone. Oftentimes, it was quite obvious that he had a boss with him. We interview one subject in the film, a rescue worker who, before the bombing, witnessed McVeigh in a phone conversation taking orders from someone. Who is this person? Who are these people? We need to know this because they have blood on their hands and federal law enforcement is not doing anything about it.
Well, how does this Andre character tie in?
Andre Strauss-Meyer is a mysterious character. He extremely his father was, he's a German national, German citizen. He served in German special forces as an intelligence officer for German. He was providing intelligence for German special forces. His father was the Secretary of State of Germany, which is the approximate level here would be Secretary of the Interior in charge of the state itself, not foreign relations. That's how they term that in Germany. Anyways, Strausmeier is a big shot. Okay. He's from a big shot family. He's from a politically connected family. He has his own credentials as a intelligence officer. He leaves the German army and comes to America in the early 90s and starts posing as a Nazi, a genuine German Nazi. And he becomes ensconced with the neo-Nazi movement here in this country. And he immediately starts telling them to start blowing buildings up, okay? Provoking them. There's a name for this. It's called provocateur. And most people stayed away from him. In fact, Strausmeier was chased out of Texas by a Texas militia group called the Texas Light Infantry because they were suspicious of Strausmeier and his intentions and all his statements. So they put him under surveillance. And one evening, the militia followed him as Strausmeier went to the Bedro building in Fort Worth to a side door and used a key code to get into the building. Okay. So the TLI told Strausmeier he's no longer welcome. So Strausmeier left there and he came to Oklahoma and he got in with a neo-Nazi community. I've been there. I'm not going to call it a compound because it's not like fortified. It's just a collection of housing. It's out in the sticks. But they're neo-Nazis, most definitely. They hated it. And yeah, and that's a whole other interesting story. But Strausmeier went there and became chief of security for the neo-Nazi community there and started, you know, telling them that they needed to strike back. And they started conducting recon and scout missions of the Murrah building. This was reported by another ATF informant, Carol Howe. The informants, they rarely do they know each other in an investigation because that's how you keep each other straight. And you don't want your informants cooking stories up between each other just for the paycheck and so forth. But an ATF informant was reporting to her superiors about this crazy German, Andreas Strausmeier, who's telling everyone to bomb stuff and is going to the Murrah building and doing recon. And this came out in trial. But it turns out Strausmeier, well, he's one of ours, according to the government. So he was left alone. So Strausmeier had an interesting arc. Right after the Oklahoma City bombing, he left the country and went to Ireland and tried to get in with the Irish Republican Army to tell them how to use them, to bomb stuff. They told him to leave the country. And so get this. Andreas Strausmeier, the neo-Nazi German, goes to Israel and started working on a kibbutz, which is basically a settlement project, and acquired an Israeli girlfriend. So that's a pretty interesting arc for a neo-Nazi to take.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting.
And Andreas Strausmeier has basically admitted his role. I mean, none of this stuff is secret. It's all out there. It's proven. Andreas Strausmeier gave an interview in the late 90s where he started talking about himself in the third person. And he said, what if the informant didn't know that people were going in to be in the building? What if it was supposed to be empty? How would the people react? And this information is consistent with another revelation that was made to state Representative Charles Key as he was conducting his grand jury investigation. One of the staffers for an Oklahoma senator at the time, I'm not going to reveal the name, but for one of the two senators in Congress that we had, one of the staffers had a meeting with Charles Key, the state representative, and told him that their brief was that, at least this is what they were told, their brief was that basically the ATF was conducting a sting operation, that the building, they expected the building to be blown up at night when it was empty, that they expected no casualties, and that something went wrong. Huh. That was the brief given to the Oklahoma Senate delegation, passed on to the Oklahoma State Representative. So Andreas's admission is consistent with other information that separate information has come to light.
Yeah. Well, now, is he likely to have been the John Doe number two that they were looking for?
He was one of them. There were several. There were several. There was the most notorious John Doe number two. We know who he is. We know where he lives, but we're not going there yet. Okay. I'm not going to reveal any of that. There were several John Doe number twos, and the most notorious one is known. He has returned to the country. He spent a good decade out of the country, but he has returned. It's not Andreas Strassmeier. It's someone else. Andreas Strassmeier is now in Germany, and he runs a toy soldier company or something. He's, I don't know. But
well, that brings us to Jesse Trentadue. Can you talk about that story?
We interview Jesse Trentadue in the film. And Jesse Trentadue was, there were a lot of Marines, U.S. Marines from the Marine Corps involved in the making of this film. I was in the Marines, and several of our witnesses, Don Browning, the police officer, Jesse Trentadue was in the Marines, Craig Roberts, Colonel Roger Charles. So kind of a Marine mafia, as they term it, was involved in the making of this film. And Jesse Trentadue, we became very close over this issue. We interview him in the film. He's an attorney in Salt Lake City whose brother was murdered by the FBI after the bombing in a case of mistaken identity. This has come to be known to be true. And he had no connection to the Oklahoma City bombing besides the death of his brother. As his investigation into the murder of his brother continued, it kept on drawing him to Oklahoma City. And he is currently involved in a lawsuit. He is suing the government, the FBI, for possession or release of all of the surveillance videotapes related to the bombing, not just on site, but everything. Thousands of surveillance videotapes were taken. Only one or two were shown to the public, and they don't show anything. And believe it or not, the FBI insists to this day that the reason they cannot produce them is that they are simply lost into the ether, just completely gone. And that is why they can. And this is a familiar, this is a continual theme with the FBI, just losing key evidence, videotapes in particular, that is resurrecting the news these days. As people become familiar with how craven the FBI is now, it's been like that for a while, I'm sorry to say. And they were using this behavior in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Wow. So the poor guy in jail, mistaken for Andre Strassmeier, perhaps. Huh?
Well, we believe he was mistaken for someone involved in another investigation named Richard Lee Guthrie. Basically, McVeigh had been, we have evidence that McVeigh at least was briefly involved with a bank robbery crew called the Midwest Bank Robbery Gang. It was a neo-Nazi bank robbery gang, and it appears that McVeigh was at least briefly involved, and we have evidence that suggests that he was involved in at least one heist with them. But they were all running in the same circles. McVeigh was running in neo-Nazi, radical, violent neo-Nazi circles. And then we have evidence he was involved with this bank robbery crew. One of the members of that bank robbery crew is Richard Lee Guthrie. Richard Lee Guthrie is a suspected accomplice to McVeigh in the bombing. He bears resemblance to some of the John Doe number two pictures. What happened with Jesse Trentadue with his brother, Kenny Trentadue, was basically they had the exact same profile. They could have been identical twins in terms of physical appearance. They even had a tattoo in the same place of a dragon on their forearm. And they both had a similar criminal record. And they had both been members of same affiliations, Aryan Brotherhood, and so forth. And Richard Lee Guthrie was known as a master of disguise and changing his identity. So what Jesse Trentadue believes is that federal law enforcement thought they had nabbed Richard Lee Guthrie. And they went in to conduct an interrogation, and Kenny fought a physical interrogation. They tortured him. We know this.
In prison.
Yes. They zip-tied him. They injected him with caffeine. This is from the autopsy. They injected him with caffeine, and they started beating him on the soles of his feet. You inject people with caffeine in order to enhance pain under torture. They knew what they were doing. And then they held him down and started beating him on the soles of his feet, which is a very sensitive part of your body. Apparently, he fought back. He injured at least one of them. And they took a zip tie and they put it around his neck, and they closed it, and he was dead in 30 seconds. Jesse believes that this was a case of mistaken identity. They thought they had their hands on Richard Lee Guthrie. They conducted a physical interrogation. It went wrong, and they terminated the subject. But they terminated the wrong subject. It wasn't Richard Lee Guthrie. It was Kenny Trentadue. And when they turned the body over to the family, it was quite obvious that it was not a suicide. Okay, quite obvious. And that lawsuit continued. And the family won a judgment for that act, millions of dollars from the government. But Jesse continues his quest to find out the truth, because he knows his brother was murdered because of the Oklahoma City bombing. And Jesse doesn't like the FBI since they killed his brother. He's from West Virginia. He takes grudges seriously. And he's continuing to punish the FBI by holding their nose to the grindstone of having them embarrass themselves by saying that they have lost the videotapes. He's suing for possession or of the videotapes.
And what videotape?
All of the surveillance and security video footage, not only of the day of the bombing, but prior to all the convenience stores and all the establishments that McVeigh was frequenting and was reported in. We know these videos exist. In the film, we interview the guy who was in charge of the video replication service for the FBI, who copied all the videotapes. For weeks, FBI agents rolled tape into his office on dollies, and he replicated them, two or three copies each. Some of the videotapes, more than two or three copies. He didn't see any of it. They kept him out of the room. He just plugged it in and hit play on the button and made sure it worked. An FBI agent made sure that he would not see what was on there. He had to be in the other room. But he made hundreds of copies of video, and none of them have ever been presented or released. And the FBI now claims they're simply lost.
But they got a good judge, huh?
The federal judge in the case is actually sticking to the guns of law. FBI is producing, Jesse is producing paper in court showing that the FBI is lying about their statements, and the judge says, you're lying to me. So now I must appoint an investigation. He's actually conducting an independent federal investigation, from what I understand. So, just whenever you give up on, all law enforcement or whatever, it's easy to become bitter and disenchanted.
Yeah, it is.
There's still lots of good guys out there.
Thank God. We're hoping for some justice on the 9/11 front. Also right now, and finding some good judges who are requiring NIST and FEMA to turn over the data that they used to create their Building 7 study. And the judge, they said they lost him also, by the way. Can you imagine? And the judge isn't buying it at all. And so requiring them now to turn it over. And
one of the pieces of evidence that Jesse produced in court to show that the FBI was lying is a Secret Service document where they're viewing, the agent who's writing the report is viewing the surveillance video of the front of the Murrah building where the truck bomb was. And in his report, he says that multiple suspects, plural, exited the Ryder truck prior to the explosion. He's looking at the videotape. He's writing a summary of the videotape contents.
Wow.
This particular document was leaked to Jesse by someone in the FBI. Okay.
Wow.
And he presented it in court, and the judge like, FBI, you're lying to me.
That's incredible testimony. That brings us to Terrence Yeke, who is central and suffered a tragic loss of his own life in this process. Tell us about him.
Officer Terrence Yakey was a police officer who he was the first officer to respond to the bombing. And Officer Yakey was not just, you know, a random cop. He was a pillar of his community. He was one of the chief spokesmen for the DARE program in the state of Oklahoma. He traveled all over the state going to classrooms, talking to kids about not doing drugs. And that was a big deal. He was a huge guy. Terry Yakey was one of the largest officers on the force and a huge teddy bear. So he'd go to these classrooms and all these kids would just crawl all over him. He was a hero to them. I still am in contact with some of these people who were children at the time, now adults. We talk, and they were greatly affected to be told a year after the bombing that their hero had killed himself. Why? Well, that's a good question. If that occurred, we don't believe it was a suicide, and there's reasons why. Officer Yakey was the first officer to respond to the bombing. Like I said before, he noted that there appeared to be federal law enforcement surveillance of whatever was going on, not rescue efforts. And he started talking to other witnesses, other cops and so forth about what he had seen, what others had seen. He was involved with many of the victims and survivors and first responders who themselves were pressing for these issues. You have to understand that the truth effort to find out what happened in Oklahoma City did not originate on the fringe with some wackos. It came from the people there in the building who were asking questions about what had occurred. A year after the bombing, Terry Yakey was found on federal land. He was found outside a federal prison, El Reno Federal Prison Facility. He was found on federal land. He had been shot, stabbed with a knife, slashed with a knife. He had dozens of wounds. He had a bullet wound to his head that entered the top of his head and came out the lower jaw from the side. There was no powder burns on the wound. They ruled this a suicide. When his body was discovered, they could not find the weapon. And an officer down brings a lot of response. There were officers shoulder to shoulder through that grass looking for that gun. Couldn't find it. Then the FBI comes in. Bob Ricks, local FBI agent and now in charge, comes in and lands by helicopter, walks into the woods, comes out 5 minutes later with the pistol that supposedly did the job. But they never performed ballistic tests on the pistol. The autopsy revealed that Terrence Yakey had no drugs or alcohol in his system. Actually, there was no autopsy. I correct myself. They did not conduct an autopsy. They conducted a preliminary medical examination of the body, but they never conducted an autopsy of a dead police officer who's found under these circumstances. Officer Terrence Yakey, earlier that evening before he died, had called a friend of his and told him that he was moving stuff from his personal storage space, and that as soon as he shaked these federal agents who were following him, he's a police officer, he knows what's going on, that he would meet him for dinner. Well, he never made the dinner appointment, and his body was found the next morning. At the same time, soon after his body was found, the FBI badged their way into his bank without a warrant, simply bullied their way in and emptied the contents of his safety deposit box. We don't know what was in there. We suspect what was in there, but we'll never know. This is speculation. This is not in the film. We only put things in the film that are 110% confirmed, but speculation will actually informed word on what Terry had was an actual videotape from the Oklahoma City Police Officer Evidence Room, Police Department Evidence Room. He had a tape, and apparently it might have been in a safety deposit box because the FBI was extremely interested in emptying that puppy out unlawfully, illegally. They had no reason to do this. Why is the FBI emptying out a safety deposit box without a warrant?
Yeah.
But they did. And Officer Yakey saved 8 lives the morning of the bombing. He worked on rescue until he fell into the crater and became injured. And the interior crater, not the crater in the street, the the crater inside the building.
There was a second crater inside the building.
Well, the second cavity of explosive force was inside the building, that, okay, unrelated to the crater.
Okay.
And they credit him with saving his life. Richard Yakey was due to receive the Medal of Honor from the Oakland City Police Department, the highest level award. The day he was supposed to receive that medal was the day of his funeral. Oh. Instead of getting the medal, they buried him. And whatever he was going to say as the hero, he was on the cover of People, Time. I mean, he had become briefly a national figure, although he quickly shunned the limelight. He was not interested in that. But he was, if he had won that Medal of Valor and started speaking publicly, because he hadn't spoken publicly, all his investigative efforts had been private, conducting on his own time with people he knew. He hadn't gone public. He was planning on going public after he got the medal and was the national hero, and then he was going to start saying things. And he had evidence, and that did not occur. And that act of killing, he was murdered. The evidence is presented in the film. It was not just to silence Terry Yakey, okay? That was primary. But it was to silence anyone else involved in law enforcement who wishes to come forward. Terrence Yakey's death has been brought up to me in conversation by local police officers when the subject of the Oklahoma City bombing came up, and I was discussing Yakey with them, other aspects. They would bring up Yakey and say he was murdered, that they all knew it. And, okay, lesson learned, and no one's coming forward after that.
That's kind of it, huh? When was that?
1996. His May of 1996 was when he was killed.
So a year after.
Yes.
Oklahoma. Wow.
Yeah.
And it's just gone silent, except for State Senator Key, who started the Oklahoma Bombing
Investigation Committee.
Investigation Committee. Tell us about Charles Key and that work.
It was such a pleasure in this film to work with so many genuine heroes.
Yeah.
Genuine, by every deaf, moral and physical heroes. Charles Key is one of them. He was an elected representative at the time of a small suburb of Oklahoma City. And he was in the state legislature. His former secretary was killed in the bombing, so he had a personal connection. But he was receiving queries and statements from his constituents talking about, you know, the ATF wasn't in the building that day. I mean, what's up with that? I mean, all kinds of things. And he started asking questions. You know, why aren't these questions being answered in a truthful or even believable manner? Okay. And after trying all official sources to find out why, you know, people are lying, he was getting stonewalled. So he formed the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee to look into the matter, and they were able to garner enough signatures under state law to impanel a grand jury investigation of the bombing. Unfortunately, the person conducting the grand jury investigation was the district attorney of Oklahoma County, Bob Macy, who was a longtime opponent of any truth-seeking efforts when it came to the bombing. So basically, the investigation was handed over to the Fox to investigate the chicken coop. And obviously nothing came of that. But so being frustrated in that aspect, the OKBIC published their report in book form, the final report of the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. And I believe the final report is available still online. You'd have to look for it. But that is the published documents of the Bombing Investigation Committee. And those are affidavits. Those are witness statements. These are FBI 302 accounts of people saying that the government, you know, they have no explanation for this fact. In fact, they're lying about it.
And who investigated the building damage themselves? Was that FEMA or the American Society of Civil Engineers?
Well, I believe the ASCE was not allowed on site, from what I understand, to conduct their own investigation. There was a FEMA report on the damage to the building, and this report was contested in the grand jury investigation and did not, just like 9/11, just simply refused to explain so many things and lied about things like the size of the crater. Okay, that's a very simple, thing that a tape measure can solve. But in FEMA's own reports, they greatly overestimated the size of the crater by 200 or 300%. And we show this in the film. The people on site, rescue workers on site who were there, they measured it. They knew how big it was. So when they saw the FEMA report, they're like, "Why are they saying it was this huge monstrosity of a crater when actually it is pretty minor? It's a pretty small crater. It wasn't
underneath underneath the Ryder truck.
Yes,
it was small. So they had
We believe that the device in the truck was acetylene-laced explosives. The police officers on the scene report finding acetylene caps everywhere. And this is never mentioned by the FBI. They never incorporate this, and they never explain why this. But the device in the truck was simply to destroy the truck. That's it. And it did. It destroyed the truck. But the damage to the building was from interior-placed explosives by someone who kind of knew what they were doing.
Yeah, really. That's what it seems like. Gail tells me that we've got some questions. Holland, you want to take some questions?
My pleasure.
All right. Let's see what we got. Hi, Gail.
Hello, you guys.
How's it going here in the chat room?
Yes, we do have a lot of good questions.
All right.
All right. So the first question is, why were 13 surveillance cameras tapes suppressed from view at the Tim McVeigh trial?
Well, that's an excellent question that I would like an answer on. They said they lost them. They've lost all relevant videotape footage. And like I said, there's a lawsuit being pursued. I mean, I doubt that it's going to produce the videotapes, but we're still holding still rubbing the FBI's nose in their own doings over this matter, over their own lies. Hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The next question. Is it true that Hillary Clinton was to be indicted for Whitewater 4 days later, but because of this bombing, all documents were lost?
I know nothing of an imminent indictment of Hillary. I'm not discounting that. I cannot establish that. But the Whitewater investigation was happening, and those documents, for a fact, were being kept in the Murrah building. This is not a secret. And Kenneth Starr, the chief counsel for the Whitewater investigation, did admit that the destruction of evidence did affect the course of the investigation. So if there was going to be an indictment of Hillary, I can't help but think that this may have assisted in that matter. But that is speculation. I don't know.
Okay. Next question. The effects of the Oklahoma City blast were equivalent to over 5,000 pounds of TNT. When the planes crashed on 9/11, the blast equivalent was never investigated. How powerful were the explosions on 9/11? That might be a question for Richard.
Yeah, I don't. That's a good question. Well, there's the plane impact into the building. How powerful was that kinetic energy? How powerful was the resulting ignition of jet fuel? I'm sure some of that has been done, but even NIST acknowledges that the jet fuel was burned out within, mostly outside the building. 90% of it, and then 10 minutes later we have normal office fires and the jet fuel is gone, and then we have normal office fires. So the jet fuel was and the jet impact was almost inconsequential, and that's proven when the witnesses, hundreds of them, of explosions before the towers came down. So that's another story. Oh, by the way, we'll be telling that story next week on Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, right here at richardgage911.org. So be sure to get our email so you can get advance notice of our weekly webinars and our other guests here. I'll put something up here on the screen for you guys.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Next question. The effects of the... Oops, sorry, I was reading the same one over again. Why was the Clinton and other key prosecutorial legal evidence moved into the Murrah building before the attack?
Were you aware of that? That's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question, and there is a definite answer. According to federal law, if an official is being investigated in the government, the evidence has to be moved out of that person's Governor Clinton of Arkansas. It had to be moved out of Arkansas. They had to store the evidence out of Arkansas, according to federal law. And the closest federal building to Little Rock was Oklahoma City. So that's where the Whitewater investigation documents were being held there, as confirmed by Ken Starr, as confirmed by the IRS. They were being held there. And the reason why is because some wrinkle in federal law that dictated they had to be moved out of Arkansas.
Okay, thank you. Is McVeigh still alive? Was he a patsy like Oswald?
If McVeigh is still alive, someone please let me know so I can go find him and, you know, physically interrogate him. Okay. Yeah. But no, I don't believe so. I don't know. I don't believe so. There's no reason for him to be alive. We do. I mean, his death was funny. His eventual death. McVeigh was sentenced, was given the death penalty as well. He should. First of all, McVeigh was not innocent. Okay. He was involved and he is a perpetrator in the murder of 169 innocent people. Okay. Not innocent. He was involved. Truck driver, lone guy, the only guy. No, he was not the only guy. He was a member of an operation. Okay. He was not the boss. He was not the lone perpetrator, the lone gunman, whatever. He was a cog in a deadly machine. But some reason that people still speculate he might still be alive. You know, that's just opinion on my part. There's no reason to keep him alive. But his death was funny. He was the first person to be executed in many decades on federal death row. And they never conducted an autopsy, once again, but even though federal law dictates that you conduct an autopsy of an executed federal prisoner, they just did not do it. First, you think they would try not to mess this one up. It's the first one in a while, yet they did. No autopsy, and his death certificate lists his occupation as U.S. Army. Now, he wasn't in the Army, supposedly. He had been in the Army a decade before, but he had held a number of verifiable jobs between the Army and the day of his crime. There's no reason to list his occupation. It didn't say, it wasn't asking if he was a member of the military. No, occupation, U.S. Army. Now, maybe that's just a paperwork foul up. Who knows? But if they had filled out that blank correctly, they would have put down a hardware store clerk. That's what they would have put his occupation.
But apparently his family thought that he was actively in the military up till Oklahoma bombing, right?
Yes, my co-writer on the film and author of her own book on the Oklahoma City bombing, Wendy Painting. She is independently after the film, she published a book based on her doctorate thesis on the Oklahoma City bombing. She actually got her doctorate on investigating the Oklahoma City bombing and turned it into a book.
Wow.
And she acquired through FOIA the FBI transcripts of the FBI after the bombing. They took McVeigh's immediate family and they put them up in a hotel so they could protect them and then, you know, have them close by for questioning. And after the first day or two of questioning, the family is in the hotel asking themselves, according to the FBI wire transcripts, why does the FBI and the media keep on saying that McVeigh's out of the Army? He's not out of the Army. He never left. He's in special forces. And we know that McVeigh applied for U.S. Army Special Forces. This is part of the official story. But the official story dictates that McVeigh washed out on the third day due to blisters on his feet. Which really does not make much sense. Anyone who knew McVeigh said that he was driven as a trained soldier. He excelled as a soldier. He was promoted above his peers precisely because he would not drop out of things because of blisters. You know, he was known as a fanatic for the Army. So maybe he did drop out, but we started conducting investigations, started talking to Special Forces veterans, and they're like, what are you talking about? The third day of tryouts, you're still answering questionnaires and stuff, man. You're not, you know, doing arduous physical testing. They're still, he said, basically that's the conclusion of the psychological testing. And McVeigh later wrote in a letter to his family that he had been selected out of special forces for induction into another branch of the government, intelligence, involved in basically deep state operations. Now, maybe this is just McVeigh trying to impress his family or whatever with stories that happens from time to time. But there's no indication that McVeigh was lying. And the Defense Department to this day has always, even to McVeigh's defense counsel during his trial, has always refused to release his medical, his complete military record. Refused to be released. So we don't know. I suspect he was still involved. And a police officer, Craig Roberts, who worked for the FBI, says in the film, he was deep state. He was sheep dipped into deep state government work after being selected out of special forces. So I'll take his word on it. And I do believe that he was still working for some element of the government at the time that he was planning and plotting and executing this attack at the behest of his superiors.
And being involved with these neo-Nazis, he may have been an informant for them.
Oh, yes. I have conducted extensive interviews with the neo-Nazis that McVeigh was approaching and trying to get involved to commit federal crimes. They immediately, like the chief of security for Aryan Nations, whom I interviewed, immediately said, this guy's a cop. Because he had been dealing with federal undercover operations. That was his job, to prevent, you know, infiltration by federal law enforcement. And he immediately sniffed the guy out. Yeah, McVeigh was a cop. I'll tell you right now, he swear on a stack of Bibles. I mean, McVeigh was calling for meetings, you know, in hotel rooms. Okay. You don't hold secret meetings in hotel rooms. That's where federal law enforcement's in the next room recording everything. You don't meet in hotel rooms. That's ridiculous. And they know this. Only cops do that. And that's the first thing McVeigh wanted to do. He did not want to meet in their homes. He said, no, let's meet in this hotel I'm getting, or hotel room. Like, they were selecting spots. You know, you come over, we'll talk, but no. So they just no-show. They stopped showing up. Yeah, they would tell McVeigh, yeah, I'll be there. Yeah. And then they just no-show. Okay. They knew he was a cop.
Hmm. So. Okay. Now we have another question. Thank you. That was a very good answer. Could the guest comment on the airport near Oklahoma City that was a known meeting place for the CIA clandestine operatives and pilots?
Can you repeat that question, please? I didn't get the first part.
Yes. Could you comment on the airport near Oklahoma City that was a known meeting place for CIA clandestine operatives and pilots?
Are you aware? I can't. I don't know about it. I have no doubt, but you know, I do know nothing about a specific airport.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. Were there any instances where mainstream media accidentally reported the truth? Or got caught in a lie, like Dan Rather's instincts on the BBC Building 7 with 9/11?
That's funny because, well, I mean, yes, there were several times. I referred to earlier the ABC's 2020, an investigative news show at the time. I don't know if it's still on the air or not. I don't watch TV. But ABC's 2020, which was one of the premier investigative news shows at the time, they did do an entire special segment dedicated to both the ATF being absent from the building and the presence of the Oklahoma City bomb squad the morning of the bombing. Apparently, the bomb squad in Oklahoma City was tasked to go looking for something at the Murrah building. We don't know what they found or if they found anything, but several witnesses report the bomb squad before the... I am not saying, and I do not think that the bomb squad planted the bomb. No. Okay. But some reason, the bomb squad was there looking for something.
And before the bomb.
Well, yes, at the Murrah building. This is reported by people in the building. Police officers, 2020, covered this. And then, like I said before, they simply refused to run the second, more in-depth segment. Pressure was put on them by the DOJ, so they just dropped it. ABC dropped it. So that's one example of the media telling the truth. And examples of the media lying are to their legion. That would be a long list.
Okay. Gail. Have again. All righty. Are you familiar with Cody Snodgrass's book, Choosing the Light?
I haven't read the book, and I'll be very brief and succinct on this because I'm not an expert, but Cody Snodgrass apparently claims to be a whistleblower, that he had some role or had knowledge of the bombing for CIA or someone. The researchers whom I trust, my partner's investigation, they discount his testimony.
Oh, so he was the guy who says that they approached him, the FBI or some CIA or somebody, to blow up the Murrah building.
Yes, and that he turned this job down, as I recall. And like I said, actually, I was open to the testimony, and I'll rely upon the opinions of my fellow researchers who tend to discount it. And now if Cody wants to talk to me and we can, whatever, that'd be awesome. You know, I love to have him, you know, in depth, you know, establish that his testimony is true. That would be awesome. But as of now, it's not really, they're not going after it. The people who are still working on this. So,
okay. Is there any information of Mossad, Zionist, or Masonic orders involved with the Oklahoma bombings?
Masons, I haven't found the dark hand of the Masons yet involved in this. And as for Israeli or Mossad involvement, I have not found any overt. The only mention paper that I see on Mossad anything is that the local Jewish community here in Oklahoma City, they gave a tour of the damage to the building after the bombing, basically hosted a tour for a representative of Israeli intelligence to come check it out, which is pretty standard. Every intel agency in the world came here to come check this out. The British were here big time because they had a lot of dealings with ammonium nitrate bombs in Ireland, and they wanted to check out the supposed damage from this ammonium nitrate bomb. So there were a lot of representatives from foreign intelligence here after the bombing, just conducting their own reports. As for prior Mossad, so-called Zionist involvement, I have found none. I do not have the final answer to this or anything, but I haven't found, Mossad or Zionist puppet strings yet.
Okay. The next question is actually a question for all of us. Does it trouble you that the perpetrators of this and other false flags are still at large?
Yes.
Yes. A resounding yes.
They
all right.
They set us up for 9/11, and then we got 9/11. So, yes, they were still at large, and it is deeply troubling, I imagine.
There's a cast of characters who move between both Oklahoma City 9/11 and the Trade Center attacks in 1993. So,
yes,
it's something we did not explore in depth in the film simply because we ran out of time. 2 hours was the most we could pack in without getting tedious. So,
you want to name some names?
There was one man who has a variety of names, who was involved as a suspect in the Oklahoma City bombing. He was seen in the presence of Tim McVeigh, hanging out with McVeigh. He's an Arab man. He's from Iraq. And he was later implicated in the 9/11 attacks as perhaps a member of support crew. He worked at Boston's Logan Airport as a baggage handler, the suspect in the Oklahoma City bombing during 9/11. So we have, I'm not going to give his name out because now he's now publicly available and we have reached out to him, and it's quite obvious that he has some kind of brain damage now.
Oh,
okay. He doesn't know things, like there's something wrong upstairs. So I'm not going to put his name out there because he's a vulnerable figure now. He has nothing that we can use, and anything that he would say would be discounted because he does have problems. But there was a small group of people who have been implicated, tangential ties. I haven't looked into that material in a while, and I'll look into it, and I'll forward you some links, Richard, perhaps. So maybe you can look at that stuff. And Kevin Ryan also has done a little work on that also. So the work out there has been done on there on links between the attacks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. What happened to Terry Nichols then? I don't remember hearing of his execution.
Well, he was not. Terry Nichols was the only person implicated as a perpetrator in the bombing. Tim McVeigh as the mastermind and Terry Nichols as kind of a hapless accomplice who was kind of forced into doing it by the government's own admission. McVeigh threatened his family. But Nichols, since he did not report the bombing and supposedly assisted in the manufacture of the bomb, was found guilty, as you know, he was involved. But he was tried on both state, two trials. On the federal level, he was tried, and the jury refused to execute him. They wouldn't do it. So the state put him on trial with the intention of executing him. Huh. And the state jury came back. They said he was guilty because he was involved, but they wouldn't execute him because the four person of the state grand jury, and we showed in the film during the press conference announcing the verdict, says the reason we didn't execute Terry Nichols is because there are other accomplices out there walking around that the government refuses to indict. We're not going to just execute the one guy the government says is involved when we know and we saw evidence was presented in court that there were other people walking around, that they are known by name, they are identifiable. So we're not going to be the government's hitman on this. And they refused to execute him. So Terry Nichols, I believe, my personal opinion, is he was the only person other than McVeigh implicated and indicted and found guilty simply because he was the only person around McVeigh involved in the operation who wasn't working for federal law enforcement in some capacity or as an informant. Terry Nichols was the only civilian who didn't know what was going on. So they indicted him and then went in prison for the rest of his life. And then they threw his son in prison. And Terry Nichols is certainly not going to talk about anything after that. Terry Nichols has offered. He offered to tell the Justice Department everything he knew about the bombing, including other people involved and including, and he named McVeigh's superior who was telling him to carry out this operation. And the Justice Department refused his proffer and refused to take his testimony. And since then, Terry has been tight-lipped. We have people who have written him letters to try to see what he knows, but Terry doesn't really want to talk about it. He's just, you know, his family is vulnerable now. His son is incarcerated, last I checked, so he's vulnerable. So I don't think Terry's going to talk really about what happened.
Okay. What's up with the Oklahoma governor's brother or brother-in-law who was working on a manuscript of a novel in 1993 titled The Last Jihad and had a Tom McVeigh that blows up a government building?
It wasn't a manuscript. It was a published book. Okay, it was a manuscript. It was published as a book in 1996, but it was written and on the press table before the attack. And this is one of the extremely strange facts that come up. And this was reported on in the news and then just immediately not taken up again. This could have been an explosive angle for any news organization to go after. But this is true. I have the book. I read it. The governor of Oklahoma, Frank Keating, he was formerly head of the ATF, a member of federal law enforcement, head of the Treasury Department section that supervised the ATF. Frank Keating's brother, Martin Keating, works for Naval Intelligence and wrote a book called The Last Jihad. In 1994, he wrote it. And it had a very strange dedication. I have the book. It has a very strange dedication in the title pages to the Knights of the Golden Circle, which is a historical group. I'm not sure what he's referencing to today. I don't know. But in this book, Final Jihad, it features a series of terrorist attacks on the country. And by the way, It's a pretty terrible book. If you're reading it for entertainment, I do not recommend it, but it's good for information. And describing a series of terrorist attacks on the country that include attacks that sound similar to 9/11, airliners crashing into buildings, and an attack on the federal building in Oklahoma City by a truck bomb. And the perpetrator in the story is named Ted McVeigh.
Spelled Tom.
Well, it's Ted or Tom.
It's Ted.
I believe it's
Ted. That's incredible.
But it's spelled differently. It's not the official McVeigh. It's spelled another way. But this is not written after the bombing. Okay. This by Keating's own. See, Martin Keating, the author, took credit, like being a prophet of what's going to happen, because he wrote this book. We know he was at the publisher before the bombing. And this book describes the name, the attack on Oklahoma City, and the name of the guy. And also the fact in the book, the attack is foiled by an Oklahoma State trooper. Oh. Well, in real life, in Oklahoma City, Timothy McVeigh, after the attack, the first time he was ever arrested in his life was for carrying a concealed weapon and speeding after the bombing by an Oklahoma State trooper. And the videotape of that arrest has been lost also. So,
of course. Okay.
Lost.
Yeah. Regarding the hero Black police officer who helped save lives that day of the Oklahoma bombing and was suicided by the feds, does the storage unit still under his name house all his evidence that he had?
No, everything was plundered. Terry Ickey was physically interrogated. They didn't just torture him. They were interrogating him. They wanted and when you're being sliced open with a razor blade, you're probably going to spill. That's what happened to Terry. They were cutting him with a razor blade and beating him. And they got everything. Well, I talked to someone involved with Terry, friends, and that their house where Terry was keeping things was broken into immediately after his death. And the only thing taken was that box. Like it was in a crawl space in the closet, you know, behind a bunch of other stuff, you know, and that's the only thing that was taken. So they interrogated Terry. They got what they wanted, and then they dispatched him, and then they went and got the stuff. We conducted a diligent search for anything that Terry may have left behind, and it's not there. Terry was not, he wasn't cowardly. Okay. They were also, I'm sure, threatening his family. He was a family man. And torturing him. He had no choice but to divulge what was going on and what he had.
Okay. Was William Cooper's work/story used in this film/documentary?
No, there's no reference to William Cooper in the film.
Okay. Holland, where can we watch your Noble Eye documentary?
It's available for free viewing on a number of video engines. I know for sure it's available on Rumble and BitChute without issue. YouTube, once they figure out that it's been, they usually strike it whenever someone puts it up. When they figure out where it is, they take it down. So you can find versions on YouTube, but I don't suggest offering any viewership to YouTube unless it's like Richard's show or something. But it's just kind of hard. But on BitChute or Rumble, you can find full to end. Just like I said, search for A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City Bombing. You'll find it. And it's 2 hours long. And that'll be it.
Okay. All right. Do you know who did the physical cleanup job and where the debris evidence went? Thanks.
The building itself was allowed to stand after the bombing for close to a month. Then it was imploded, demolished, over the objections of the local recovery operations, because there were still bodies inside. They hadn't
gone. Oh, my God.
And according to them, the building was stable. It wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't going to fall. It was stable. But the building was demolished without an independent investigation, without even the defense team from McVeigh or Nichols being allowed to view it. They were allowed to stand across the street and they wouldn't even take the tarp off from the crater when anyone was there. But the building was demolished by a company called Demolition Incorporated.
Yeah, there's a kind of, the cleanup and, at 9/11 was by CDI as well.
The same people too. And not just the same company, the same exact names. And the wreckage from the Murrah building was buried under armed guard out on the outskirts of the city, Wackenhut security guards guarding it so no one would dig it up and do residue tests on it.
Oh, my gosh.
And now any efforts to get in there are gone now because the Yoakum City Police Department put their racing tarmac, you know, I mean, their driving training tarmac course on top of the wreckage. So you it's literally covered in tarmac, so you can't get to it.
That's crazy. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of the Gulf War Syndrome records were lost, plus original Native American treaties, right, in that building.
I do not know about Native American treaties, but the collection of military medical records pursuant to the class action lawsuit against the Department of Defense by a number of millions. The class action lawsuit had millions of plaintiffs, military members, or at least hundreds of thousands. All the records, including the plaintiffs' military health records, and all of the records were being kept in the Murrah building for the purposes of that investigation.
Okay.
I don't know of a direct link. I don't know if they're connected, but that is truth. They were there.
All righty. From the Noble Lie documentary, they had a clip of Tim McVeigh's death row cellmate saying Tim McVeigh was getting his orders from someone he called the Colonel. I believe, is that true?
There is a series of books written by a federal death row inmate by the name of, as I recall, David Hammer. He's from Oklahoma. A series of books were written. These claims have been thoroughly investigated, and it does appear that McVeigh and Hammer were carrying out conversations where McVeigh was revealing things that were previously unknown. Hammer had information that was unknown up until that point that we were able to independently verify as true upon seeing the information Hammer presented. We looked into it, like, wow, that's Hammer was talking to McVeigh. They were on the same, you know, in the same unit, same cell pod or whatever you call it. But in subsequent books and claims, David Hammer also says things that are untrue and are plagiarized from other people. Like, we found them. Like, you just read a book, man, and put it in your book. Okay. I mean, we see the source. I know the author. Okay. And also, here's the thing. The first book David Hammer wrote is very interesting, and what he refers to as the Major. Okay, we've been able to make some headway on that, and I can get into it. But anything and everything Hammer has to say is absolutely discounted. He is a convicted murderer and con man who is running swindles from federal death row. He was running credit card scams on the warden. Okay, I mean, the guy is literally I'm paying him a compliment. He's literally a criminal mastermind. Okay. He is genius. If you look at his criminal record, it's pretty interesting. But this is just another adventure for him. He did have information. He did talk to McVeigh, but it is simply impossible to verify what and or if all of it is true. And all of what that Hammer has to say, there is some stuff in there that we know is untrue, and we know where he got it. So he basically, after the first book, he kept the ball rolling, and he just started adding stuff. So it's interesting. It's worth a look, but we cannot take anything, and no one can take anything Hammer says is credible. He's on federal death row, and he deserves to be there. Like, he killed his cellmate. He's killed more than one person. So, I mean, yeah, sorry. But,
okay. What about Tim McVeigh stating that he was being controlled by something up his butt when he was caught. Is that true?
Oh, okay. One reason that the media mocked Tim McVeigh as a crazy conspiracy kook is that McVeigh had been telling people that the military had put an implantable microchip device in his buttock, in his rear end.
Right.
So, yeah, that sounds crazy, but why is it untrue? We know that McVeigh's unit in the Army was part of a psychological experiment being conducted by the Army called the Cohort Program, where basically they usually in the military, you know, you just kind of get mixed in with when you transfer unit to unit. It'll be a totally different set of people. What the Army was experimenting with was a program whereby the Cohort Program, where you would stay with the same group of people you enlisted with in boot camp throughout your entire career, the same core group of people. And it was an experiment to determine if this would lead to more unit cohesion on the battlefield, more effective fighting soldiers. And McVeigh's unit, he was part of the Cohort Program. They monitored his unit's progress in the Gulf War. I mean, McVeigh won a Bronze Star in a war that lasted 4 days.
A battle?
Yeah. And the war itself lasted 4 days, you know, and McVeigh managed to win a bronze medal out of that. And his unit was being monitored and its progress and results compared to non-cohort units. And there were psychologists and all kinds of weirdos involved in this experiment. So I don't know anything about the chip in his buttock, but why wouldn't they? I mean, that's a convenient place to put it. And if they're tracking your, and the fact is that the Army was working on an implantable locating device in your buttock at that time. We have not established that McVeigh was part of it, but the Army was working on this. So it cannot be discounted automatically as crazy.
If it was there, probably on the outside, inside of the skin, but outside of the anus. That's what I'm guessing.
That, I hope not. Yeah, let's hope so.
I wasn't looking at the details. Who knows?
I'm just trying to eliminate the visualization. Maybe I made it worse.
No, that made it worse. Now we're trying to figure out exactly what you meant.
I was trying to avoid that part.
I was too. You know what? Okay.
I'm blushing.
All right. Yeah, you are. Your ears turned red. Okay. Didn't McVeigh petition not to have an autopsy performed?
Yes.
What? Really?
Yes. He petitioned, and this was granted despite it being federal law to conduct an autopsy and execute a federal prisoner. And no autopsy was performed. Apparently, this was at the request of McVeigh, and no one can understand why the federal government decided to obey his wishes in this matter, but they did. And honestly, the reason people think McVeigh is still alive is things like that. And also, in the film, we interview Janie Coverdale, who lost two of her children in the bombing. She, well, sadly, I must report here that she recently passed just a couple months ago. So if you're seeing Janie Coverdale in the film, keep in mind that she's no longer with us. That is her last testimony. Anyways, Janie Coverdale was invited and participated in the closed circuit viewing of the execution of McVeigh. From Oklahoma City, she was allowed to come into a room with some other invited people, including a few journalists, to view the execution of McVeigh by closed circuit television. What she describes is that the TV comes on and it just shows him, his face. There's a sheet from neck down and it just shows his face and he's just looking at the camera. That's all. And this just goes on for a couple minutes and then they turn it off and then they say it's over with.
Oh, that's suspicious.
Now, I don't know. I don't know that he's alive. I don't think he's alive, but there's a good reason that people think he's alive because there actually is no proof that he died. There's no proof. So I have received reports from people who report seeing him after the fact. There's just no way to verify them. So,
right. Yeah. I can only speculate. All right. How did McVeigh's lawyer allow the DOD to violate the rules of discovery by refusing to release McVeigh's records by order of discovery?
Well, his military records were sealed by order of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is according to McVeigh's defense counsel, who wrote a book, a very good book, a good primer on the bombing, his defense attorney. Name escapes me at the moment, but you can find it. A number of very good books have been written on the subject by journalists and truth seekers. And yes, the military record of McVeigh was only released partially and never fully, and this was on order of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A lot of his medical record was suppressed also, and this is something that my co-writer in the film, Wendy Painting, who later wrote her own book, more on this subject, discussing his very strange medical records, which included a gigantic amount of medical visits, like over 100 medical visits a year for all the years, the 3 or 4 years he was in the military, in the Army, which I myself served in active duty infantry. McVeigh was an infantryman like I was. And I know for a fact you don't get to see the doctor that much in a combat unit. You rarely, if ever, and if it becomes a problem, they make it a problem for you. And his medical records, and this is just not my opinion, I showed them to an expert on military medical records. And he said that these are the strangest medical records he's ever seen. Why would a grunt be receiving hundreds of medical appointments a year? And furthermore, when you talk to McVeigh's army soldiers in his platoon, I asked them, did McVeigh have missing time? Was he going to the doctor a lot? Was he gone from training a lot? They're like, no, never. He was never gone. So we don't know what those records mean. We don't know.
Interesting.
Okay. Do you think that Timothy McVeigh was an MK Ultra type patient and tool, because how could he keep the lie under wraps and not want to plead his innocence, especially if they were going to execute him?
Well, I have a different answer for both. One is, yes, I do believe he was subjected, and we present the evidence, talk around the film, and Wendy wrote about it more extensively in her book, that we do believe he was subjected, at least after the fact, after the bombing, to some kind of programming by Dr. Jolyon West, who is head of the CIA's MKUltra mind control experiments. Like, he was McVeigh's shrink after the bombing. Now, as for him keeping quiet about his role or the role of others in the bombing, we do believe that there was leverage on McVeigh with his sister. This is no secret. The records are there. The statements are there. McVeigh introduced her to the crowd that he was running with, which is criminal neo-Nazis. And Jennifer may have conducted illegal activity. And this was leverage that could be used. Tim and his little sister were very close. He would have done anything to protect her. She may have been dragged into illegal activity, and she was now vulnerable. And we do believe that was one of the reasons Tim was reticent about what happened. Now, I'll tell you this. Wendy and I, we tracked down one of the prime investigators for the defense counsel, the former assistant police chief of Houston. He was retained by the defense counsel to be their chief law enforcement investigator. And he wrote some of the most interesting memos that we read in that entire investigation. So we needed to talk to this guy. So we tracked him down. He wasn't expecting us because he was not conducting interviews. And we tracked him down to his house. We were nice. We just walked up, and we waited till he stepped out and talked to him. And he said, I would have done the same thing you did. So come on in. He told us some things, but we asked him about McVeigh and why he kept quiet. And what Richard Reyna told us was that he sat down with McVeigh in the same room. And for once, it's just him and McVeigh in the same room. Usually there's other people, but now it's just him and McVeigh. And Richard had just gone to Arizona and Utah and Vegas and talked to all these people who were hanging out with McVeigh and all of this, and had a lot of interesting information. And Raina sat there and told Tim, you tell me, Tim, what exactly were you doing? And who are these people that were helping you? Why are you keeping quiet? And what Richard Raina told Wendy and I was the conversation that happened in that room is something that I will never divulge.
Wow.
Did not. Richard Raina didn't tell us a thing because the conversation was in private and not to be divulged. So yeah. Richard Raina is an honorable man. And even for that, he will not break his honor. And I respect that. So yes. McVeigh.
Oh, I lost him.
I think the defense counsel was so frustrated with McVeigh was like, they're like, man, we can get you off. I mean, like, we know that you were not, you know, innocent, but you were just a cog. We can prove this. And McVeigh was refusing to cooperate with his own defense to help them with this. That was their frustration. Like, this guy's not helping us. Like, he's every time the FBI would adjust their story, McVeigh would reinforce it. Huh. So, yeah.
Yeah, he's a good soldier.
Yeah.
There's two more questions here for you. We'll end this. This should be, well, we hope. Well, we'll see. Go ahead, Gil.
What does Holland speculate was the purpose of this bombing?
Good question. And this is speculation on my end, informed speculation, but I don't have the final answer. What I do believe is that this was a multifold mission with multifold desired end states that they wanted. On the political level, basically, you have to remember, if you were alive then or can remember back then, 1995 was kind of the end of history in terms of the 20th century. The Cold War was over. For once, we had no external enemies. And there was a major, and I know this for a fact because I was kind of talking to those people at the time, there was a major anti-government rhetoric and movement going on in the United States at the time, the militia movement was rising up and becoming a threat, so much so that intelligence agencies were talking about it. The head of the CIA, William Colby, said it was the greatest threat the federal government has right now is this nascent militia movement, which was demonized after the bombing because McVeigh was hanging out with the militia, making a fool of himself and suggesting foolish courses of action that will get you arrested and largely getting kicked out of meetings. But he was hanging out with the militia movement. So it led to the demonization of that. It led to the demonization of basically any anti-government rhetoric. And I'm not anti-government. I'm anti-corrupt government. Okay. And basically shut all of that down. And also there's Bill Clinton. You have to remember politically the year before the bombing in 1994, and I'm not taking sides in any political debate, but what happened was the Republican Revolution. The Republicans, for the first time in history, gained both houses of Congress from a Democratic majority. And Bill Clinton, according to Dick Morris, his own chief of staff, was scared, scared stiff of losing election. Like, he faced a major, like, we might be a one-term administration. And after the bombing, a reporter asked Bill Clinton, what do you owe your political, that's when he became known as the comeback kid. In the 96 presidential election, he was able to overcome the Republican Revolution and retain the presidency. And he became known as the comeback kid. And a reporter asked him about this. What did he credit his comeback to? Bill Clinton looked at the reporter on Air Force One and said, the Oklahoma City bombing. It brought the country together and, you know, whatever. So now I doubt that Bill Clinton, ordered it. I believe that Bill Clinton was helped out by the intelligence community, a portion of it at the time, because, you know, he works for them. He was doing their bidding in Arkansas. That's what Whitewater was about. So that's one reason. Demonization of the so-called right-wing Republican viewpoint, demonization of the militia movement, Bill Clinton's political aspirations, the Whitewater and Gulf War Syndrome investigations were centered out of there. I do believe there were a lot of eggs in that basket. Which was the primary trigger? I don't know.
Okay. Well, here's I see the question. I'd like to ask this one.
Can you go ahead?
Yeah. Do you have any works in the pipeline in terms of filmmaking, Holland, or what are you doing with your life now?
Well, with my life, you know, I work in and off film periodically. I've worked as a script doctor for a local independent film in Oklahoma City, taking part in productions there. And I've done screenwriting. I've been contracted for screenwriting for a number of books and authors. Right now, I'm in South Texas. A couple years ago, I started working on a documentary about the shrimping industry. And we're still putting that together. And I got involved with the fishing industry. And now I'm involved, I'm working as a commercial fisherman here in South Texas, selling seafood to market. And we're manufacturing fertilizer out of our fish carcass waste. So that's the startup I'm involved in right now, having adventures down in South Texas. Wow. And also filming everything I can and trying to put it together. But as for Oklahoma City, we are still investigating this. At least as much information has come out almost as much information has come out since the film as before. The investigators and the authors are still continuing to research. Jesse Trentadue, like I said at the beginning of the show, has been in contact with the producer for the Tucker Carlson show. And they have been chatting a while about the FBI's involvement in contrived undercover operations like January 6th. Mm-hmm. Apparently there's going to be a segment coming out about Oklahoma City involving a newly found witness. And also, there is a continuing federal master investigation, which is a rarely used, rarely invoked term in federal law enforcement, where a federal judge appoints a third party to investigate the government. And that's what's happening now. They're trying to locate the videotapes. The search for the perpetrators continues. They have been identified and located. They have been watched.
And we're now there's a lot more people watching.
Yeah. We know they're there. But, you know, really some of those characters are dangerous. So we're airtime with that. And the investigation continues. And most definitely does.
We watch our backs. Wow. Incredible. Thank you so much for being on Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, Holland. I'm so grateful to you.
I'm grateful to you.
We will have to connect up with you on your future projects and see how much more waking up you can do in the American public. We're grateful to you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Gail. And thank you, Rich, for having me. We've known each other a number of years. I'm really glad you had me on your show.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm honored. Thank you for illuminating us. Okay, there he goes. And Gail, we'll let you go too. And guess what? We've got a little treat for our guests here on the way out.
A jingle.
Thank you for joining us on yet another informative and soul-stirring episode of Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next week with another very special guest in the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond. Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and, of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.